You build on failure. Use it as a stepping stone. Close the door on the past. You don't try to forget the mistakes, but you don't dwell on it. You don't let it have any of your energy or any of your time or any of your space. Johnny Cash. It's time to move on. This is Inspiring Educators, episode 22. What's your worst nightmare? What do you take for granted most in your life? Do you have the opportunity to pursue your dreams? If you were given a clean slate in life right this moment, an opportunity, a hope, how might you live differently? Our guest today has lived through a life of hell on earth. Incarcerated when 17 and spent 20 years in prison for first-degree manslaughter and dealing drugs, his life would take a dramatic change in course when given the opportunity to study and earn an associate in arts degree from Bard College through the Bard Prison Initiative. Bard Prison Initiative, or BPI, is a rigorous college in-prison program that enables students to earn Bard College degrees while incarcerated, with nearly 300 students enrolled across 6 New York State prisons and supporting other colleges and universities across the country in entering this field through its National Consortium for the Liberal Arts in Prison. BPI has awarded nearly 300 associates and bachelor's degrees. Having earned a scholarship to study under Bard Prison Initiative, our guest today was able to study, and with each class and book consumed, the opportunity to pursue his dreams became a reality. Our guest today on Inspiring Educators is a BPI graduate, Donnell Hughes. Welcome, Donnell.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Hey, Donnell, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Just want the audience to know, Donnell just returned from his class at Baruch College about an hour ago.
Yes, Baruch College, Citizenship and Public Affairs.
So you're having a pretty busy day, and this is a Sunday too, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I know some people say, why did you pick classes on a Sunday and a Saturday? And I was like, well, I got to get the job done. But I definitely had a busy day today, and the day is still going to be busy after I get done with this interview. But it's a good thing, though.
We'll try to be efficient in this, give you plenty of time to get back to your assignments, all right?
Yes.
Donnell, I'd like to start with a quote from one of my favorite books that I read in high school, To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, where it says, you never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb inside of his skin and walk around it. Can you share with us, growing up in New York when you were young, and what was your family situation like?
I was born into a family of, seven. It was my mother, my father, and I have four other brothers. So basically it's five of us, five boys. I had a pretty much, loving mother and a loving father. I had a good family. My father, he was a working man. My mother, she worked also. And generally, if my household was full of love. It was full of love for a while until I was about 12 or 13 years old. That was around 1986 or 1987. And it was that year where my life pretty much went down to hell. My father, he got strung out on crack cocaine. So that year was kind of a real difficult year for me to accept that my father was out in the streets getting high and leaving my family to, be in such of a dire situation. My father, he ended up leaving my household, and because of that, me and my brothers, we suffered. My mother suffered financially, emotionally, psychologically.
Sure.
And those were like the beginning years of my life spiraling downward.
Mm. So how old were you at this time?
Oh, I was 12 years old. About 12 years old, yes.
12. Okay. So you're about you know, in junior high school.
Yes,
about seventh grade. Right,
about seventh. Yeah, seventh grade at that time. I was in seventh grade.
And so up to that point, I mean, you were more or less a pretty good student in school and just going about like every other kid in New York.
Absolutely. Yes, I was a pretty good student. You know, like every other kid in school, I had my share of, you know, days and fighting and stuff like that. You know, that's what most kids go through. But overall, my grades, were good. And I had most of my teachers, they loved me. But after my father got strung out on drugs, I became more of a complicated student. You know, I began to fight more in school, began to have low self-esteem because of, you know, the circumstances in my household. And because of that, I found myself getting into more and more trouble. But yes, generally, I was a good student. You know, I didn't ask for the life that came afterwards, but I guess that was just the consequences of my father's problems.
And, you know, when during that period, do you remember, were there teachers who kind of recognized, you know, something's changing with Donnell, and, you know, were they trying to do any type of intervention? Do you remember or recall any of that?
I remember the teachers. One of my teachers in particular, her name was Miss Wallace. And she used to always tell me that, oh, you have a lot of potential. You're an excellent student, but you have anger issues, and, you know, you're fighting. And because of that, sometimes she and I kind of had conflicts because of my behavior in classes. So, but she always recognized certain talents and gifts that I had and my intelligence. But because, like I said, because of my issues at home, they interfere with my coursework, my classwork, and my behaviors in class. But she was one of them she was the first teacher that really recognized what was going on in my life at that time, the problems that I was having.
Donnell, what was your childhood dream back then, you know, when you were in junior high school? You know, at a young age, what did you aspire to do with your life back then?
Oh, I loved art. Like, art, I wanted to be, like, this big artist. At that time, I liked to draw. But I was always into the arts, music, just art in general. And whether it was theater or, like I said, drawing or music, I was just an artistic person at that time, and that was my dream, just trying to be an artist in some form or fashion.
So everything kind of seems to crumble around you. You would eventually get into drugs and start dealing drugs, right? Can you kind of give us a chronology of, you know, how your life started to unravel?
Okay. Well, in about 1989 or 1990, like I said, my father, he was already far gone by this time, but during 1989 and 1990, my mother, she couldn't really deal with my behavior problems, like my anger issues and so forth. So I was put in a group home called Leek and Watts in Yonkers, and it was then when I started meeting other kids that were there because of, you know, anger issues and issues with being out in the street. So I got, like, really close to these other people, and I got introduced to the drug life through them, as far as, you know, gaining knowledge about what type of drugs were out there, what could I do, and what the drugs, and how much money I could make, and so forth. So when I came back from the group home, that was one of the first things that I tried to do, get into the drug game. And the reason being is because, like I said, my mother, she was struggling. She was on welfare. My father wasn't in the house at that time. So like any other kid that grew up in those neighborhoods, particularly Harlem, where I was living at that time, I wanted things. I wanted the things that other children had, like that their parents could afford to get them, And my mother couldn't afford to get me. Like I said, I had four other brothers that my mother had to take care of, so it was really difficult for for her to really get the things that we wanted, like clothes, sneakers, and, you know, the games, and, you know, pretty much what children want. So because of that, and because of my desires, I went out there, and I met a few guys who older guys at that time who were willing to give a young guy like me an opportunity to sell some drugs to make money. Because think about it, back then, the older guys, the younger guys didn't really get into too much trouble for selling drugs. If we got arrested, it was like a slap on the wrist. We might go through some juvenile detention center, or we might, you know, get some type of leniency because of our age. So they were giving drugs to us like it was candy. So I got with some older guys. You know, I started selling drugs for them, and from there on, I just got like really, really into that lifestyle. Everything that came with the lifestyle, the jewelry, the females, you know, everything. You know, the clothing, the fashion, and I just lost myself in that lifestyle.
Mm. So at this point, what about your siblings? What about your other brothers and your mom? How are they carrying on with the loss of your father?
At that time, I really didn't know how my brothers were affected, because I'm the oldest. My brothers, they're younger than me. I didn't really sit there. I didn't understand their pain at that time. I didn't understand what they were going through, and nor did I know how to ask those questions at that time. So I was just really worried about how I was affected, or I just dealt with how I was being affected with his loss at that time, as far as him leaving my household. But my mother, she went through hell. I mean, psychologically, emotionally, there was times that she wanted to give up. Like, you know, she just wanted to give up, whether it was contemplating suicide, whether it was sending me and my brothers to foster care because she couldn't support us. So she dealt with it very hard, but she was strong. You know, she stuck it out, and she tried to do the best that she can. She tried to do, I can honestly say that she really, really tried to keep me and my brothers on the right path. But as a single mother, it's difficult. It's difficult to raise five boys. You know, so...
Yeah, but, single parents.
Exactly.
Wow. Is your mother still with you guys?
Yes, she's still with us.
She is? Okay, good. So, you know, at what point, how old were you when you had the first brush with the law?
My first brush with the law was, I was 14.
14.
I was 14. It was fighting during lunch hours in school, and I got arrested for it. Me and a couple of other young guys that I was with, we ended up fighting a few other guys, and I got arrested for that. But it was a situation where I went through the system. That was my first encounter with the law, as far as going into a precinct and actually having them call my mother to come get me and stuff like that. But as far as actual arrest and a conviction, that actually came later on when I started selling drugs, when I was selling drugs in the downtown Chelsea area when I was 16 years old, about 16 years old.
So you would eventually spend some time in prison. Ultimately, you would end up being charged and convicted of first-degree manslaughter as well.
Yes.
And you received a 20-year sentence for that.
Actually, I received an aggregate term of 16 to 40 years, but I ended up going to the parole board three times during my incarceration. I got denied parole twice, and my third time around, they finally released me.
The statistics on African-American men and in our society is just staggering. You know, 1 in 15 black men are incarcerated in the U.S., and within 5 years of their release, more than 3 out of 4 ex-inmates are arrested again, and it's just a revolving door. And when you first stepped into the walls of the prison, I mean, did you just Was there a moment in your life right there where you just felt, okay, things are changing here? What was going through your mind?
Like any typical teenager, I was scared to death. it's funny because when I was in the streets, I didn't have that type of fear. Like, growing up in Harlem during the 80s and 90s, at my age, a teenager becomes accustomed to the lifestyle and becomes kind of hardened from that type of lifestyle. So we learn not to fear certain things in the city area where I live. So when I went to prison, because it was such a culture shock for me, I'm like, okay, now what am I going to do? And I mean, this is a whole, I'm in a big house now. You know, there's people here, hardened criminals that's worse than me, and I didn't understand or know how I would be able to survive in a situation like that. Because now I'm by myself. I'm no longer with my mother. I'm no longer with my friends. I'm by myself now. I have to protect myself, and I have to worry about COs and other staff that's going to pretty much keep me in check. So I didn't really know how to deal with that change at that time, and I was scared. I was scared of the unknown at that time.
So you were incarcerated in 93?
Yes, 1993.
And I mean, was there even a moment where you lost all the hope that this is it, this is my life, I'm in here for, you know, however long it's going to be?
Mm-hmm.
Was there a point where you just realized, you know, there's no hope, and just kind of live day to day and survive?
Absolutely, absolutely. At that time, it was. You know, I used to hear stories about young guys such as myself getting 30 years, 35 years for murder cases. And I was charged. I was initially charged for murder in second degree. So I thought that because I was charged with a serious crime such as that, I thought I was going to do about 25 years. Plus, along with all the other crimes or other charges that I had. So I thought I was never coming home. I actually thought that I was never going to come home and that this was my life and I would have to make the best out of it. And because of my thinking, I got into a lot of trouble early on during my incarceration. To me, it was about survival of the fittest. So,
sure. What was the most difficult moment while you were incarcerated? Do you remember?
The most difficult moment? The most difficult time was when I was going to trial. When I was going to trial was the most difficult time because everything just looked so bad for me. You know, I got convicted for my first case, and I was given 5.5 to 16.5 years for that. And then I was convicted for my gun charge, and I was given about 2.5 to 7 years for that. And when I started going to trial for the homicide, I just, like, that at that time, it was just like, it's over for me. It was so depressing during that time that I really didn't know what to do. I was 18 at that time, so at that time, I really didn't know what to do. When you're 18 years old and you're fighting a case that's so serious like that, you know, it's emotionally wrecking. So
at what point did things start changing for you? Before the Barred Prison Initiative came up, have a sense, I got to get myself out of this, I need some hope to keep myself going and keep that hope alive? When did things start changing?
What started changing in my life at that time was, I think it was around 1999. When I was in Eastern Correctional Facility, I actually got into a program. It's a program called the Braille Transcription Center. So I got into Braille transcription as a way to keep myself busy. So I learned a few skills, such as computer skills, transcribing Braille materials and large print materials, and because of that, the data entry skills and other skills that I acquired with transcribing Braille, it kind of prepared me for a higher level of education. So when Bard College came in around 2001, I just wanted to get involved. I felt in my heart that the only way I'm going to really be successful, if I am ever released from prison, I have to have some type of higher education. So with that being said, I was very, very determined to get in college and try to change the course of my life through having a college degree. So that's when things changed for me as far as academically, around that time when I wanted to pursue my college degree with Bard when it came in 2001.
You know, just taking back, okay, you say you were doing Braille transcription. Do you actually read Braille as well?
I used to read Braille. Yes, I used to read Braille. Because we were doing a lot of transcribing for different high schools and colleges, it was a requirement that we had to learn how to read Braille, especially from the actual materials, the Braille materials. We had to learn how to read the contractions, the alphabets, and all the other different forms of Braille. So I did, at that time, know how to read. It's been so long that, you know, I forgot how to actually do it. But, yes, at one time I did learn Braille.
I mean, how many people know how to read Braille? You know, I remember, just coming across a Braille book at one point and just putting my fingers on it, trying to distinguish the difference. I couldn't even tell the difference.
Yeah, you know? I know. And the thing about it, because your fingers have to be sensitive to it. You know, the one thing that I've learned about the blind is that once you lose one of your senses, another sense becomes stronger. So the blind, when they lose their sight, their fingertips become more sensitive to the things that's around them, and so they're able to feel the Braille itself and make a easy determination on what the contractions are. But yes, it's going to be difficult for you because you're not blind, you know what I'm saying? But it was a great skill to have. It's definitely it was a great service to provide, and it was a good skill for me to have at that time.
It must be very humbling, you know, what you were doing and helping those that are disadvantaged and, unable to see. There must be a certain amount of pride in what you were doing at that time.
Yes, it was. It was. And it was a lot of us. It was a lot of us in a Braille Transcription Center. It was started by prisoners on Rikers Island in the city, and it was brought up into the New York State Department of Corrections. And we did that work pretty much voluntarily. And we did take a lot of pride in it because we thought that this was a way that we could actually give back to the community at large or give back to society, even being in prison. So it was just, for me, at such a young age to learn that skill and to find value in that, it was good for me because now I became service-oriented because of it. So, yes, it was a lot of pride. A lot of us had a lot of pride. We were so happy just to provide that service to people that needed it, you know, after taking lives and you get what I'm saying? So, yeah.
Absolutely. At around 2001, Bard College introduced the Prison Initiative Program for inmates. Classes were taught by the Bard College faculty and participating instructors from other institutions such as Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health and MIT. As I was looking over the program, Donnell, as with anyone else applying to a university, it's competitive and you have to compete for a spot in the class.
Yes, it is. It's very competitive. When they came in, actually they started a program called the Clemente Program, and they brought in a few students. It was a pilot program that they just wanted to test the waters on. So they picked these students, and based on the students' performance in that Clemente program, that was going to be the determining factor of whether they were going to bring an actual college program in, an actual degree program. So that was the first stage. But after that, it became so competitive, you had to do essay. They give you three different essay questions. So you had to write an essay, and then you also had to go through an interview process. And from that interview process, Bard only accepted 15 students out of a large student body that actually went and took the essay exam. So it was very competitive from the beginning stages. And it's very competitive now. It's still like that to this day. So, but again, they only allow 15 students out of possibly anywhere from 100 to 150 students that apply and take the FA exam in whatever facility that Bard College is in at that time.
Okay. So how did you find out that you were accepted? Who told you?
They put a list up. They don't actually tell you personally. They give a list to the academic supervisor in the facility, and the academic supervisor places the list up, and we have to go down to the academic office and look at the list to see who actually made the cut. So that's how I found out. I found out through a list.
And do you remember what you felt when you saw your name on the list?
Yeah, I remember definitely. I was elated. Just put it like that. I was elated. I was just so happy that I finally did something of real significance in my life as far as how society would view me. Like, you know, education is a very important thing in society. And for a person that's incarcerated to get this opportunity to become college educated, you know, it was a big deal to me. I couldn't wait to call my mother and tell my mother that I got accepted into college. I just couldn't wait to just go around and just, you know, just show my happiness.
Well, you know, do you remember what your mom said?
My mother, she went crazy. She said, she was jumping for joy. And she was just happy for me. My mother, she was just so happy for me because, you know, just think about it. You know, your oldest son is in prison for, you know, decades. And to see your oldest son, your firstborn child, finally try to make a change in his life that can affect the rest of his life in a positive way, I know she was happy. I know she was very happy, especially because of the type of young man that I was, very wild and hard-headed. So for me,
And there's nothing like seeing a happiness and a smile on a mom, is there?
Absolutely. There's nothing like that.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that.
Once you found out, I mean, you must be just on cloud nine. Can you take us to, what your first class was like when you sat there and you're starting your first college class? What was that like?
It was scary. I was nervous. I'm not even gonna lie to you, but my first class, I actually had two classes, because the Bard curriculum is so intense for that matter. They only offered us two classes at the time because they wanted to see if we could handle the work. So my first class was English Composition 1, and my second class was an elective class, which was a history class, Europe since 1945. And that was a course that was generally about the whole European history, starting from World War II up to about the creation of the European Union. So, but they were very intense classes. It was difficult for me because I haven't been in school for over 10 years when I got in Bard College, so I had to catch up on my writing. I had to learn how to do citations, to avoid plagiarism, and all that other stuff. So it was intense for me. It was very
intense.
So,
you know, as you're going through there, you have butterflies in your stomach, and you must be just so tense because I imagine you just want to do the best job and get the best possible grade, obviously. And I guess all these feelings are, normal feeling that any other college students would feel. And, as you're sitting in there and learning through all these things, I imagine, you know, you eventually start relaxing a little bit more and start getting more focused in the classwork and all. As you're taking these classes, English composition, you're writing and you're learning about post-World War II European history, at what point did you just realize that, you know, this stuff is interesting and, you know, the world is so fascinating? I mean, what type of, what did you learn that just kind of also, wow, you know? This stuff is really just fun.
I learned culture. Like when I started really getting into the European history, the wars that happened during the European after 1945, I kind of got a feeling of actually wanting to learn more about just people in general, different cultures in general, and because there was like a lot of during those times in Europe, the different religious and ideological type of conflicts, those are things that I really wanted to learn more about. Those are the things that I really want to learn more about, because when I started learning about different ideologies, I really started feeling like I didn't know anything. You know what I'm saying? Once you learn about different ideologies, it's like, okay, you know, what do I really know about the world? So that's what really wanted me to learn more about the world at large, just knowing about different ideas and different ideals that people have, especially in Europe and other continents and countries.
Mm-hmm. Can you share with us probably the most eye-opening class you had over those years, and you're studying for your associate's degree?
Yes, I do. I do have a favorite class. It was critical thinking and informal logic. That was my favorite class because it was a required class in Bard, because it really showed me how to look at the world from a critical standpoint, whether if I'm reading the news or looking at a talk show or just, you know, having a regular conversation on a daily basis with a person and the art of argumentation, those different things, because it showed me how to actually look at things critically and actually be a type of person that knows how to support my arguments and stuff like that. That was really important to me. That was really interesting to me. That was my favorite class because of that, because it taught me how to.
Okay, so Daniel, I got to ask you. So as you're, you know, taking these classes, you know, every semester and so on, did other friends and inmates did they start noticing that you know, you're behaving a little bit differently and you know, just kind of thinking differently, talking differently? I mean, did somebody say, you know, where are you coming with this stuff? Did you ever have that type of moment?
Yeah, definitely. In the yard. Well, because before I went to college, I spent a lot of time in the yard. I spent a lot of time doing Braille transcription and into music and stuff, but I spent a lot of time with my friends walking around the yard and really talking about nothing. So now that I'm in college, I got so much, you know, information that I can share with them, and I became that type of person that always wanted to share information to them. So I could say around my second semester in Bard, that's when I started hearing people saying, "Yo, Darnell, you becoming a nerd." Like, you, yeah, seriously, yo, you a nerd now. You're not one of us anymore. You in school, you big college guy now. And, you know, if I was younger, I probably would have took offense to it. But now that I'm older, I kind of like being called a nerd. So it was during my second semester when people started noticing the changes, and they started noticing the changes in what I wanted to talk about, what it is that I wanted to talk about now, not what was just, you know, convenient for us being in the yard.
Wow. So you become a teacher to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're walking around, you actually became a teacher to some of your friends, talking about your ideas. That must have been a really powerful feeling for you.
Yes, it was. It definitely was. But the funny thing is that because they knew the type of person that I was, they were willing to listen. even though they had these smart remarks and stuff like that, but they were willing to listen, sure. And they gave me a platform for me to pretty much retain what it is that I was learning. And sometimes they'll ask me about certain things too, you know, something that they may have read and didn't really understand, and they'll probably ask me, did I know something, I was able to share something with them that I've learned in the classroom.
That must have been what a wonderful moment that is.
Yeah, it was, definitely.
Did you find yourself helping other inmates trying to get into the BPI program, tutoring them at all or anything like that, giving them advice how they can take some of these college courses?
Yes, yes. In fact, that's one of the things that Bard College encourages the students to do. They encourage us to go back into the population and share what it is that we have, and not only share what we have, but also to help the other people that are interested in getting into the Bard program, provide them the certain tools that they need in order to take the exam, like writing skills. On any given day on the weekend, you'll see at least 20 to 30 Bard students helping some type of GED student or pre-GED student with their writing or their math and so forth. So I was one of those students that also helped people with writing, because I became a great writer because of Bard. So that was my contribution, by helping them to write better.
Sure. Do you still keep in touch with some of those inmates that are undergoing the Bard program? Do you still correspond with them, email or anything like that?
Yes, yes, I do. I speak to a lot of Bard students on a regular basis. Out here, we have like a community or a family of Bard students that help each other get different employment opportunities, information on different programs for ex-offenders and so forth. And just to have somebody to talk to about, our challenges, the challenges that we're facing out here. So, I have a lot of different Bard students that are actually helping me through the process, through my reacclimation right now. So, but I do have a very large community, Bard community out here with me.
And in terms of, the curriculum that Bard program has set, things like European history, writing essays, critical thinking, there are people that say, arguably that, the inmates are better served if you learn vocational skills instead of, a lot of these liberal arts, curriculum that you've gone into. I mean, what do you say to those people that, let's just provide vocational skills, becoming a mechanic or a plumber or electrician like that, and because, there's a discussion saying, going to 4 years of college and becoming an English major, or studying the classics or Roman history or Greek history, these are all wasted time. There are always online news saying, students are better served going in and learning practical skills. Can you kind of, to explain why liberal arts is so critical? Why is it important to take classes like, critical thinking and history classes?
I don't really have a problem with vocational education. Because it serves its purpose. It does. It has its place in the world today. However, when it comes to liberal arts education, having the ability to think critically, having the ability to write effectively, having the ability to speak fluently, these are things that a vocational education cannot really offer you. Yes, you may be able to learn something like, you may be able to learn how to use your hands, or get a skill that, is labor intensive. However, being able to navigate through society and the world at large, a person needs those skills, those critical thinking and writing, and those speaking skills, being able to express yourself effectively and clearly. So, and not only that, a liberal arts education provides you perspective, more perspective of the world at large, different cultures, different societies. It allows you to be more inquisitive, to inquire about different things, to question things, as opposed to just, you know, living life without questioning where you at in your life, or questioning what your future may be like, or what your past was like. This is what liberal arts do for people. For me, for example, if I didn't have a liberal arts education, I probably wouldn't be looking at my life in hindsight the way I do now. This having the ability to read memoirs and see how people express the process of their lives, this learning that and seeing how people do it, I apply it to my life right now. And that's what liberal arts did for me. And that's what it could do for anybody. That's
a very important perspective, the ability to, as you mentioned, I'm just echoing what you said, to look at your life and just look at the perspective and open your eyes to things that are not necessarily visible, and to appreciate different culture and have sympathy and empathy for others.
That's right.
And so on. Yeah. I think you beautifully really put down, case for liberal arts. I always, mentioned to my students, absolutely, I agree with you. These practical skills are important, but what provides us the future and things such like hope and the connection that we feel even with our strangers, not just family and friends. Reading, these classic novels and listening to music allows us a broader connection that sometimes cannot be explained. But your mind changes, huh? Your perspective changes, and I think that's absolutely true. Thanks for that. I think that's really wonderful. It's really touching just listening to you describe Case for Liberal Arts. Thank you for that. Danielle, it's 2013, can you explain to us what it was like to finish your associate's degree when you were done with your last class?
When I was done with my last class, I was happy, very, very happy. But I also felt this emptiness. I also felt as if it wasn't enough. You know, my associate's degree, completing my associate's degree is not enough, that I had to go further, in my education. And so I took more courses, which I eventually was able to apply to my education now that I'm free. But I was ecstatic. I was ecstatic. I was happy like anybody else who had accomplished something that's very important in their lives. But at the end of the day, I think any person that goes to school and loves academics will never feel satisfied with just associate's degree or bachelor's degree. You're going to always want to go further. Even people with PhDs, they always want continuing education. They just have this yearning for education and learning. So, but that's how I felt.
You know, it's kind of funny. I'm going to use a strange analogy. My girlfriend always says, when you're eating potato chips out of a bag, you never get full. You know, you just keep eating and eating. You know what I mean? And that's what learning is like, because once you get, absorbed into just learning and you just have this thirst, it's like eating a bunch of, chips out of a bag. I mean, you just keep going and going and going. It never fills you up. And so, anyway, so you graduated, and it's a proud moment for you. And so you go for your last parole board, and your parole is approved, right?
Yes, yes. I went for my last parole board hearing. And what was great about my last parole board hearing was that the commissioners, they finally recognized, my accomplishments. My other two parole hearings, they didn't really care. But the last one, they cited my accomplishments, and it made me feel good. One of the things that the commissioner said, he said, "Mr. Hughes, you accomplished your your associate's degree, you finish your associate's degree, you've done Braille transcription, you've done HIV and AIDS counselor work. He highlighted all these different things and told me, when you go home, he said, one of the good things that you need to do is pursue your education, finish your education, and go speak to the youth. You know, share your story. He said, just don't let this be in vain. And that's pretty much been my focus since I've been home. You know, and it's a struggle. It's a struggle for me. I don't have all the things that I necessarily want right now in my life, or all the things that I necessarily need, but it's a work in progress, and those things are slowly but surely materializing. I see guys that did way more time than me out here, and they're doing great. They're doing great. They're back in college. Guys that's 50, 60 years old, back in school. Some out here, they're educators, whether it's in the health field or if it's in a social work field. But they're doing exactly what it is that they need to do in order to make amends for the crimes that they committed, and just to get back. So that's where I'm at right now mm-hmm. in my life.
So are you going around local schools in New York speaking to youth?
Right now, what I do is, like I said, I'm into HIV and AIDS counseling. So every once in a while, I go to different community centers and I give up information about transmission prevention and HIV and AIDS counseling. So, but that's that's my way of giving back to an at-risk community. I would love to get more into talking to children, but unfortunately, those options are not available to me right now as we speak. But that's what I'm doing other than my education, pursuing my education.
Yeah, and you're continuing your education at Baruch College, which is part of the SUNY New York State's public school system, right?
Yes, yes. I'm completed at Baruch College, but actually, I'm in a program which is called CUNY BA. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but it's the CUNY Baccalaureate for Unique and Interdisciplinary Studies. Baruch College is my college. It's my home college. That's the college that accepted me. But my degree plan is from the QDBA. So what it allows me to do, it allows me to create my degree, to shape my degree in the way that I want my degree. So it's sort of a liberal arts approach to create my degree, which is in real estate and urban development. So, that's what the CUNY BA allows us to do, to take our unique attributes and our personal interests and create a degree that we can use throughout our career.
I see. So what made you go, select real estate and city development?
I've always loved real estate. Since I was a kid, I used to walk downtown in the midtown section of Manhattan, and I used to always look up at the skyscrapers and like, I want one of these buildings. I used to love buildings. I love structures. And when I was incarcerated, I read a few books on real estate investing, and I took an interest into it. And one of the things that I'm really, really interested in is providing affordable housing.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. You're making money, but at the same time, helping those in need at the same time, right?
Absolutely.
Hey, speaking of, you say you like buildings. What's your favorite building in this
city? Right now? The Freedom Tower. The Freedom Tower. Right. That is a beautiful building. Yeah. I take pictures of it every time that I go to Staten Island. I love that building. Either it's the Freedom Tower or older structures like the Chrysler Building.
Yes. That's my favorite.
Older structures. Like
I love the Chrysler Building. Yeah, I love the Art Deco. I always did. I mean, it's just beautiful. I love how it just glistened, but the Freedom Tower, I'll agree with you on that one. Last time I was in New York City was, not last May, but May of 2013 or April, actually. And, you know, there's nothing like just, you know, walking around the city and just, you know, it's always lively and it's just so much energy going on. And, you know, 3-4 o'clock in the morning, it doesn't matter, right? There's always something open and so much vitality. It's just my favorite city in the world. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, I live out in the West Coast. I love the California lifestyle. But when it comes to city, there's just nothing like New York, is there?
People say that. I mean, people say it's nothing like New York, but I haven't been anywhere. Sometimes I hear people say it's nothing like California or it's nothing like Vegas. So, you know, like you said, everything is relative. Everything is relative.
Well,
and I would love to go to California. I mean,
sure.
The weather is beautiful, and, you know, it's just beautiful out there, you know, for what I've read and for what I've seen on television and stuff like that. But New York is great.
Well, Donnell, just, you know what, it'd be my pleasure to meet you here and show you around, okay? So you put that down on the list, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. Definitely.
And, you know what, it was funny because I was looking at Baruch College, and, you know, the motto of the university is the American dream still works. Do you still have faith and believe in the American dream?
Yes, I do. One thing I learned about this country is that your life is what you make it. Your life is what you make it. Sometimes, people get caught up in, you know, complaining about what it is, complaining about everything that's wrong in their lives. But the truth of the matter is this: if you make good decisions and you follow through on those decisions and you stay the course, eventually things are going to happen for you. Unfortunately for myself, I ended up going to prison at such a young age because I didn't really understand that about this country. But now that I do, and I know that there's resources available out here for me, I'm taking the steps to actually utilize those resources in a way that I could be successful and realize the American dream. But it's going to take time. But there's so much here in America for us to do, or so many resources here for us in America, that I think that anybody who really applied themselves can be somebody and be the type of person that has or can acquire everything that they want in life. That's how I feel about America.
Yeah, well said. Wow. And so here's a question, and I guess, you know, there's a lot of controversy with BPI and funding is being challenged. What would you say to those who say the funding spent on programs such as BPI is better spent on, you know, just young teens graduating from high school? And what would you say to that? What would you say to the naysayers and the critics of, you know, programs such as that you've gone through and saying this is worthwhile and why?
All right. What I would say to people that say that about providing, you know, people or prisoners education, I would say that the people that you're paying for or you're contributing to their education in prison are the same people that's going to return back to the society that you live in. And the society that you live in, you know, you will want to make a better place, generally. So the money that's being spent on prisoners getting education is are well spent dollars, for the simple fact that those same prisoners that get this education will come out and make a significant contribution to society. They will eventually make that a significant contribution. And it's actually, we can see this every day. It's not talked about a lot, but it's happening every day. You know, and I'm proof of that. No, I'm proof of that. I'm a guy that did a lot of time and was given the opportunity to get an education, and now I'm out here, you know, pursuing my education again. And any chance that I get to contribute to society, I jump on it. Like right now, with this interview, you know, who knows who's listening to this interview? What young kid that might be right now about to make a decision that's going to cost his or her life, and they might hear this interview or, you know, read this interview, and it probably changed their perspective and make them want to do the right thing or change the course of their lives. So, you know, that's what that money for education to do, you know. And we may not get it right now. You may not realize, you know, the benefits of giving that person that's incarcerated education right now, but in the future, it's going to be money well spent.
And in case you were wondering, the success of Bar Prison Initiative, BPI's recidivism rate for graduates is 2.5%, and for all students who have enrolled, 4%. While the New York State average is 40%, and the national rate is around 50%. The program is obviously providing its graduates an opportunity to succeed, and is working.
It absolutely is working.
Sure. And Donnell, I'd like to ask you, what is the biggest challenge for you right now? You're working, you know, you're going to school full time. Do you have time? Are you working part time as well?
No, actually, I'm not working at this moment because last semester in the summer too, my classes, the way my classes were set up, I had classes during the day and I had classes during the evening. So I couldn't get a job, a steady job that will allow me to go to school at the same time. But this semester, I set up my schedule in a way where I'm able to work full time. So I'm in the process of looking for employment right now.
And if there are audience members listening around New York and want some hardworking individual, you're the man.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I'm trying, man. I'm trying.
Sure. I mean, no different like anybody else, you know, just doing their best, right?
Definitely.
And Donnell, I would like, I'm going to ask you a question, okay? It's kind of, I want you to meet a troubled young man, and you're his mentor, okay? You're assigned to this young 15-year-old, and his name is Donnell Hughes. What advice would you like to give him? What would you like to tell that young man who's 15 years old?
I would tell that 15-year-old kid that good to have patience. Be patient, and in due time, you will get everything that you want in life. I would tell him to value education, because without it, you won't able to see the world the way you will need to see it in the future in order to be the best person that you can be. I would tell that kid to value family and to learn how to be himself and learn how not to let others influence his thinking. Wow. That's what I would tell him.
Yeah, really powerful, meaningful advice. And on a little lighter note there, Donnell, it sounds like, you know, you're so deep involved with studying these days and volunteering with HIV/AIDS awareness. You know, what do you do for fun or to relax?
What I do for fun? Well, I listen to music. I do basic things. I like to go out with my friends. We go out, eat. This summer, I've been to amusement parks, beaches, stuff like that, typical things. I'm not really a big fan of, like, spending any money because I don't have it right now. So I try to find little simple things to do, just like, you know, going to picnics and cookouts and little things around, like, my neighborhood and stuff, and just having good conversations. That's what I do to have fun, just simple things in life.
Yeah, you know, there's something about just the simple good things, and it's like the best things that are in the world are free, isn't it? You know, just walking the neighbors around New York City and just kind of taking all the sights and the sound, and, you know, it's so wonderful. And just like Central Park or say, and just, you know, for me, I really enjoy, you know, going for a bicycle ride and trail here. And of course, you know, the beach is fairly close here, and I just like to go and watch the waves and Yeah. Sounds like you got a lot of, good things going on there, Danelle. And Danelle, for inspiring hope in others and providing a value lesson to a lot of teens out there who are, lost and trying to find the ways and whatnot, guys who are just hurting and seeing no way out, and your life story, for showing inspiration, being an inspiring educator, and motivating these people, being an unsung hero. You are our inspiring educator, and I wish you happiness, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
And just want to let you know, Danielle, whether it be on the West Coast here in sunny Southern California, or just somewhere in New York City, I really I would really love to get together with you one day and sit down, and just share a cup of coffee or something. All right?
All right. Absolutely. I would love to do that too.
Yeah. Well, hey, thanks again. I know you have some assignments you got to take care of, and I really enjoyed this conversation with you, Danielle. And this is one of the best part of doing what I'm doing right now is meeting some amazing people, individuals like yourself.
Okay, thank you. I so much appreciate this. I definitely do.
And with the bell, that signals the end of our program. This interview is a two-part interview. In our next episode, you will meet Dr. Megan Callahan, the Director of College Operations and also an instructor for BPI. I would also like to thank Ms. Laura Liebman, the Director of Development for Bard Prison Initiative. This interview was not possible without her assistance and input. I greatly appreciate her support and advice. If you are interested in contacting Danielle or Laura, you can write to Laura at her email address, lliebman@bard.edu. That's lliebman@bard.edu. Additional information on BPI can be found at their website, bpi.bard.edu. The email and the link is on our website, inspiringeducators.net. Thank you for joining us. Through the lessons in and outside the classroom, the journeys of our guests have been more fascinating than the destination so far. If you have been enjoying Inspiring Educators, I would like to ask the audience members to rate and leave a comment with iTunes and Stitcher Radio. It does help with our visibility in the vast world of podcast multiverse and with our cause, bringing unsung heroes the recognition they deserve. Until next time, continue to inspire, and as always, carpe diem.